let's get our feet wet and let's get our hands dirty into like something that's new, something that you don't know about, and like what's the worst that could happen?
Welcome to another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials, where we help you accelerate your career and turn soft skills into hard money.
Well, welcome everyone to another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials. Today, we have a great story with Kevin. I think you're going to have a few laughs. That's a pun. You'll understand why later in the episode. But a few things we're going to highlight today are how someone can surprisingly be in both technical roles and find themselves in very surprising places, sometimes with a lot of laughter, and also how you can create a culture within your organization that really fosters the growth of these kind of elements. And as we always think about, we want to maintain our people-first power in the age of AI, and we have a great example of how to do that today. So welcome, Kevin. Great to be with you.
Great to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm excited to dig in because, boy, do we need a little more laughter in today's era. And so I want to go back just to think about, it's always good to think about how people got their start and the meandering path that led someone to where they are today. I think so many people have, they have doubts, they have uncertainty about what turns and paths that they take in their lives. And it's good to hear sometimes the seemingly random nature of life, right? And then when you look back in arrears, you're like, that was all totally like a recipe that put my life together as I know it. And so I'd love to go back in the beginning and think about, you know, you ended up, doing some tech stuff in your career, but I'm curious if you go way back, what was the first time you felt like, you know, the tech side was curious or you found that you had some interest back in your, when you were a kid?
Oh, when I was a kid, I think to the thing that really comes up at the top, I would say I was a athlete growing up. I had mentioned you on earlier in our call, I was the first person, I'm the youngest of six kids, first person in my family not to be all state or all American in any sport. And I was destined to be, you know, a lacrosse player. My family was. It was like, hey, Kevin's the youngest, but he's gonna do something. He's gonna be better than us. He's gonna be bigger than us. And it was kind of all these expectations, which I love, but I didn't realize like all the hard work also that goes into being a great athlete. But I remember going and doing that, and I was gonna go to school for the college for lacrosse, but I was the last person cut from my varsity lacrosse team in my junior year, which meant every college that was recruiting me was like, this kid is not good. Let's not recruit him. Let's not invite him. So also suddenly my future was kind of like thrown away. And I remember being like, I'm going to go to a different school. I'm going to figure out what I'm going to do. But actually what that opened up was to realize like, oh, I've kind of been putting all of my eggs in this basket. What else can I do? And that was when a friend of mine was running unopposed for student body president. And I was like, might as well, you know, I'm going to go run and do this in here. And I tried that. And that was, I know it's not like a technical thing, but I was very surprised. It unlocked a lot more than I thought. I got to start to be more creative and speak in front of people. And so I would do posters up on the, and do like my own ads. And then I did my speech and it went really well and I ended up winning. And what I didn't realize was like, as president, you're kind of like I was like in so many new committees and I was responsible for running a pep rally and t-shirts. And I was like suddenly running like this small business that was the student body. And it made me like, I didn't realize, but it unlocked all of these different components that I was really interested in. And I would say that was the first like pivot that I took into something I was really passionate about, which was entrepreneurship. And it was, all right, let's get our feet wet and let's get our hands dirty into like something that's new, something that you don't know about. And like, what's the worst that could happen? There's not much that could happen that's really that bad, but there's a ton of learnings that you can get from it, other things you like to do or things you don't like to do. And I think that was the first time like that I started to have more of a technical brain of saying like, let's start to create a pile of stuff that I'm passionate about and stuff that like really doesn't rev my engine. And let's kind of, start making life decisions in that capacity.
Wow, I love it. So, two follow-up questions. One, were you still friends with your buddy who you ran against? Like,
Well,
how did he take that?
yes, we were friends, and he was the first person I called, and I said, I want you to be kind of on our council of seniors. That was the first thing I said. And to boot, he was my college roommate my freshman year at school. So we ended up being college roommates.
Wow.
We're still really good friends to this day. And yeah, so it all ended up really well for all of
Well,
us.
those are attributes we would love to see more in politicians.
Yeah,
So,
sure.
well done there. And you probably realized at this point, I'm wearing my high school, my high school reunion, my 30th. That'll give you
Oh,
some idea
nice.
of my age is coming up here in a couple weeks. And I bet you, did you realize when you signed up for an ASB president that your job was now to organize all of the reunions
Oh, yeah.
for the rest of your life?
Yeah,
So.
that is certainly a responsibility that I have not taken on myself after college. I ret or high school, I retired respectfully and let other people take over any sort of
Yeah.
reunion. So I think everyone can thank you for all your hard work. You
Right.
deserve it.
Well, I was never an ASB person, but I definitely do chip in and I love keeping in touch with people. So this is really interesting. So I think so let's fast forward a little bit here, right? So you have this, I love that because there's these surprise moments that in this case, right, you took on a challenge and that challenge opened up a lot of very surprising doors, one of which is public speaking, which statistically many people fear more than death. And so that looks like a great avenue and something that was uncommon, but likely kind of managed the trajectory. So I'm curious, as you got into college, right, what kind of things did you explore? What did you dig into, and what did you eventually graduate with?
Yeah, so first 2 years of school, I went to Georgetown University, and the first 2 years are you're kind of taking the same classes as everyone else, the prerequisites, and I was drowning. I was like, this is so hard. I'm really having a tough time. I was terrible at certain subjects, but I just had to like really grind through it. So although those first 2 years were like really hard, it made me develop a really strong work ethic. But going back to like understanding what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. And so that was really great in those first 2 years of saying like, what do I care about? What do I not care about? What are my friends getting into, and not being so drawn to like, let me follow my friends. I really followed my own interests and I kind of let my voice speak the most. So we, even though they were my close friends, they were more into, let's say, like the finance route or, routes that I really wasn't strong in, nor did I have a passion in. So that's really where I started just explore. And the only major that I found interest in was marketing. And the other thing that they started was a fellowship of entrepreneurs at Georgetown, and I was a part of the first class of that. And so I was very passionate about just kind of like continuing to explore and creativity. And like, I just knew that that was, I always loved that like qualitative approach rather than the quantitative approach. And I knew that there was a place for both. And that's where marketing major really helped me, is kind of make stories out of data, but I really liked the ability to kind of analyze things from a taste perspective and analyze things from a human behavior perspective. And so that really, that marketing major I think really was igniting my curiosity. But then when I got into this entrepreneurship fellowship, I got to kind of see all the different ways that people could make a career, and it wasn't into getting a internship at a certain type of institution and that sets you off for the rest of your life. I just knew that wasn't my path. And so the entrepreneurship route allowed me to learn a lot of things. And I'll never forget, we had this one class, introduction to entrepreneurship kind of set the stage. And like the thing was like, reach out to three people you will not get in touch with. It was like, it can't be someone you're friends with, it can't be someone's dad, like whoever it is. So I remember I like first person, I like reached out to Steve Jobs, you know, and that was like Steve at apple.com, I'll never forget. And you know, unfortunately he, you know, I think he passed away a few weeks later. But I just like was not even aware of anything. I just said, hey, I'm just gonna reach out. This is the person that's the highest on my list. And I'm just gonna go for it, and I'm not gonna be scared of rejection. And so it was stuff that that class taught me of like, don't be afraid of rejection and like shoot for the moon, land amongst the stars. And so that was kind of a good foundation for taking those risks and saying again, what's the worst that could happen? You know, the best thing that could happen is a really strong connection. And obviously I didn't get that connection with Steve, but I ended up, you know, getting that muscle to be like, go for it and like take that chance. And so I think that combo of marketing and entrepreneurship was really, really good. I didn't realize that. I honestly picked marketing because it was interesting, not because I wanted a career in it, but I ended up selling event marketing software. So then when I was selling, it was like, okay, I know the language that they want to talk about and how marketers use it and really what they care about.
Yeah, and the storytelling related to it, I think it's there's a couple aspects that I think are really interesting. I mean, first off, the trying to overcome the risk aversion. And I think today, because so many things are, you know, for example, I've heard this phrase that the world has always been crazy. Now it's just much more well distributed, right? Like the awareness is much higher today. And so that creates this anxiety for people that they might do things that end up being visible to other people. And I think that is really important, is to have that courage and to step out and to find those roadblocks and not to walk around them, but try and to jump over them.
Totally. I
That's
mean,
good
we're also living
advice.
in a world where you post your highlights and you don't post your lowlights. And so it's like, of course, it's going to be scared to try things because you're seeing everyone around you with such high rates of success because that's all they're posting. And, you know, no one's posting like a terrible photo or like a, you know, a moment that they failed because, you know, why would they do that? And so I think it's also warped our brains too of being like, yeah, why would I try something when everyone out around me isn't? But they probably are. They're just not talking about it.
Yeah, so that's that second aspect. I mean, that's a really important kind of people first dimension there, which is vulnerability and being willing to share that. So as you dug into this as you dug into this role, now thinking about coming from marketing, the storytelling. I love the idea of telling stories related to data, another really cool and key skill, right? What it means. I remember there's a book I have by a guy named, I think his name is Tufte, Tufte, right? Which is the something related to how people use quantitative information to tell incorrect stories, right? And you have that phrase, there's like lies, damn lies, and then statistics. And so that was very eye-opening for me to see how people can tell the wrong stories related to data to try and get other, you know, kind of agendas across, which is fascinating. So learning how to tell the right story is good. And as you were part of this marketing software company, which I've used the product for probably over 10 years, and I'm curious, so as you kind of dug in there, and you got pulled into sales just because I think they were really small, and that was the opportunity that was presented in front of you. It sounds like you had a kind of a wide array of roles there. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because some of those might have surprised you a little bit in the same way, and more hurdles to jump over. And then I want to get into kind of a little bit of the culture of that organization, how they had some distinct aspects of how they set up their business and empowered their team, that I think is really useful, and there's a lot to learn from.
Yeah, so first off, I went in and I just wanted to work somewhere in New York, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. You know, I think a lot of people have this in common when they, are trying to get a job out of college. They just need experience. And, it's hard to get a job if you don't have experience. So I was just like, let me get anything. So I offered to work for these folks for free. I mean, I did for several months. And, the exchange was like, hey, come and work for me for free. And you'll learn some stuff along the way. And so that was cool. And also allowed me to like free up my time a little bit and start to also take a little bit of the air out of the pressure of like really doing a good job on one specific thing. And I started to become like a utility player. And I started to be like, what do y'all need? Because the company was so early that they didn't need anybody in sales, which I eventually was pointed in that direction after I proved my worth. But it was like, hey, we need someone to QA this product. We need someone to monitor the bugs when it gets sent to a developer. A client came in and said, hey, the header on their website's not working, and I would have to go to codeacademy.com and take classes at night to like learn what HTML was. And so it really just was like, hey, what's the problem in front of you? What are you using the top of your intelligence to execute on solving that problem? And if you don't know, are you asking questions? Who are you asking the right questions to? Are you making sure that you uncovered every stone first before bothering people with like really important questions? Because it is such a small team. So it really made me become more self-sufficient. And simultaneously, I was doing improv with my brother and my two brothers and my best friend, and we're doing improv classes with his private instructor in my brother's apartment. We'd move the couch out of the way, which was my bed. We moved that out of the way, and we do it for 3 hours a week. And it was this ability for me to, I was learning so much at these improv sessions, like active listening, thinking on my feet, not being scared to fail, all these different components that go into being a good improv performer. And I saw that carrying into the next day at work. And I just saw how similar those skills were. So as I continued to build my career, and they eventually elevated me to start the sales team, because I was like, hey, I need a real role. I need to start getting into what my career can be. And they were saying, hey, how about sales? And I think it was a low risk for both of us. And I got to learn so much. But I said, hey, while I'm doing this, I also am going to continue to dive into the world of comedy in New York City, both because I love comedy, I've always loved comedy, but also because I just started to see that it was its own form of education. It was this own form of like practicing, what you've referenced as power skills, these skills that, are, innate within us that kind of get taken away over time, especially now with AI. But like, what are these different skills that allow us to think better, be more vulnerable, take more risks, listen better, communicate better? And I just found how much those skills were translating into my career that eventually ended up being successful in that sales role.
Wow, interesting. That's good. So I think as you share this with them, right, you're making sales, you're kind of selling software, and you're essentially, right, eating what you kill every day, right, which is also not a bad thing to be into and to recognize those levers and that you're a key part of delivering on your own, your own income as well as for the business. So as you grew in this aspect of in your home, which I think is great, did you ever have people come and a little audience inside your house?
No, never. Not with the classes. And also, if they wanted to, they would have had to like be a little pencil in the corner of the kitchen because there was no room. I mean, this was a one bedroom in the East Village of New York. This was as small as it gets, but no, it was just great. Eventually we did do shows in where we invited people and we had a proper stage and real audience, and people could buy bags of beers and have a really good time. And that's where you got to be like, hey, let's see if we think we're funny, or if the skills that we're doing are turning into something as a productive show. So, we eventually got out there and showed ourselves as a group. But Eventually the band broke up, so to speak. People had responsibilities and couldn't do it anymore. I moved into a different apartment. I started getting d more into improv. I didn't stop doing it because, again, I just saw the value of it. But then I also started getting into stand-up comedy, and I saw like that was definitely where we got a I was able to perform for a lot more people. But stand-up was a whole different set of skills. Like stand-up was something that I was able to learn how to write a joke, and that these comedians that come up there, it's a magic trick. They make you think that they don't know. It's like so off the cuff. It's so natural to them that it makes you feel like it's they're coming up with it for the first time. But this is tried and true material. And I started to really learn how every word, the economy of words was so valuable. Like, how can I say what I'm trying to say in the least amount of words? And then I was like, wait, that's relevant to my sales pitch. How do I cut out a few more words in my sales pitch? Or, hey, I'm going to be public speaking. Like, what are the different, am I doing any, obviously, and like every great comedian you hear, you never hear an you never hear an and if you do hear a sound that they're making, it's a very intentional way to get the audience engaged. It's like a laugh in between a joke. It's like a very intentional word that they might use that makes it seem like they're, again, more natural and off the cuff, but everything's so intentional. And again, I brought that intentionality back into the workplace. And so it was just very cool to see, like, all right, first improv is helping me work with a team, and now I'm an individual contributor, and I'm still able to use those skills with my clients as like my new team and my prospects as my new team. But then also I can get into stand up, and I can start to learn like what is it like to connect with an audience as the only person up there? Because in improv, you got a whole group of folks, and you got a squad with you that you can lean on. And then improv's a bit more of that individual contributor role. And I think that's like it just helped me develop even more muscles.
It's interesting. I want to go back and and look at how this company you worked for, how they supported this journey in the beginning. And it also reminds me of well, one, the example of Jim Gaffigan and his like thought voice, which is really funny. Why are
Oh,
we
yeah.
talking about this? Yeah.
Exactly.
It's so great. I just love I love listening to him, and he's saying what we're thinking,
A
but
great comedian
also
that also does that move is Jessica Kirsten, and she's so hilarious. But she'll do this thing when like she's someone I worked with very closely. I've opened for her. She's absolutely one of the best working comedians out there. And she does this thing when like it's not going, the audience is not connecting with her, and she'll like turn to the curtain behind her, and she'll start talking to herself and be like, "Yeah, I don't know what's wrong with the crowd. I guess they don't want to have any fun." Kind of like that whole thing. And just like brings the crowd right back. And she's like, I know that you're a very talented comedian and you've worked really hard. I don't really know what their problem is. And it is that whole thing where you're like, yeah, everyone's got it's gotten out. It's like what practicing and doing comedy in front of great audiences, but most importantly, bad audiences. And like, how do you react? That's adversity. Those are like that playbook that Gaffigan has or Kirsten has is like that is years and years of bad experiences and them saying, I'm taking this experience back into my own hands and I'm going to be able to control the crowd. And that's what a lot of stand-up comedy is how can you win a crowd over? How can you lose a crowd, then win them back again? Like, how do you take any room and bring them on your side? And again, that was another thing that's no different than a client call. It's like these people, you're taking up their time. They might not even want to have a conversation with you. How do you win them back? And so that's stuff that comedians practice every single day.
Yeah, I love it. And so this is so great because there's such a strong correlation here between, as you mentioned, those people first power skills. And this is stuff when people go in, like a Salesforce professional has to go in and manage a room, right? There's a boardroom, there's people on Zoom. They have to manage that audience. And certainly as part of our program, we have some aspects of, that humor is vital in great delivery because it does open up that vulnerability. It kind of depressurizes the room. Especially self-deprecating humor really brings about that humanity and that connection. that hey, we're all in this together. We all make mistakes. It's okay, and we should actually accept it and welcome it because it's a necessary part of growth. We actually can't have growth without it. And I think the other aspect that's really relevant is, you know, with AI, it's a token generator. So that means that the words come out easy, right? Whether you're programming or, you know, you're coding or you're writing, but that doesn't mean the words are good. Just because they come fast and they come easy doesn't
Or
mean that
right,
they're
for that
quality and that they
matter.
achieve something. But I do want to go back and before we move continue to move forward further into this, I want to understand a little bit of how did the culture, right? Because also another aspect is the vital role of culture and values. But I'm curious, how did the culture and the essentially the commitments they made related to that culture inside this organization really stoke and support the inception of this, as you started thinking about how to start getting this in front of people and testing it out?
Yeah, so it was, you know, it's kind of a twofold thing, but you know, I owe everything to what you know, this was like my own I always look at my time at this company as another form of graduate school because I was really able to sink my teeth and really I was able to make a ton of mistakes. And I think that was what was so cool about being the first salesperson was that I got to just be in the room and just learn from people. So they also gave me this really great opportunity to be like, you're not going to carry a quota for a little bit, but you're just going to be kind of the person that's the fly on the wall. And I remember having a huge client. And it was, I wait, it was like the first time I had talked in a few months, like at an actual meeting. But it was this moment, this like sensei moment, like wax on, wax off, where I like found my opportunity to like why my listening was so practical. And I like said a very important thing in the meeting. And it was this moment where they were like, okay, let's give you a little bit more responsibility. So it was like they really allowed me to have so much ability to learn and fail and kind of like also get take responsibility. That was a really cool thing. Like the leaders in my organization, they wouldn't be very liberal with giving me the wins. Like they would kind of do a lot of the hard work and the wins, and then they would go and be like, you know, that's going to you. Like you were the
Yeah,
one
they
that
gave
kind
you the
of
credit.
gave me the credit, in front of everyone, and gave me a lot of that confidence to be like, yeah, you've got that and you did contribute to it. And you know, other managers or other folks that were in a leadership position might want to be like, no, that was all me. You know, I did it. And so I think that that was an invaluable lesson that I saw from a people perspective, you know, and managers being like, no, you were the one that drove that. And it made me want to prove them right the next time I got that opportunity. So I thought it was just such an awesome way to manage me. And I'm so grateful for that because it really stoked that confidence early. And I paid that forward, I think, later on with other folks that I ended up working with. But in terms of like the second part of this is what did they do to help me want to continue this comedy journey of mine, which was very random for them to do. But, you know, it was an events company. So they created a stage in the office separately, like not for me, obviously, but like they had a stage and they had amazing lighting and amazing sound system. And they encouraged everybody in the office to throw events. So people would throw charity events, they would throw birthday parties, they would throw you know, client events. We would have different client events. It empowered people to be like, this is yours, use it how you want, bring your own community in here, and we'll get those benefits. But it also made you be like, whoa, these folks really care about you. So much so that I had a key to the office to like go in there on the weekends whenever I wanted to, which you know, I don't think you could do anymore, but it was just like a very cool thing where I was like, hey, this is your space too. And so I started throwing huge comedy shows in this office. And like a friend of mine who was, you know, a front-end developer, he played the drums. And like the person that worked in customer success, they checked people in at the door. And it was like they didn't do it because of the company. They did it because like the person in their company wanted to do this thing and everyone was stoked about it and they wanted to support me. And it was not only like it was not just supporting me for the sake of the company culture. It was supporting me because the company had propped me up and said, hey, this is something that he's doing. You guys can go for free and this is fun. And people were like, yeah, I want to support you. And I go to battle with you every day. And it really, there was just this crazy strong culture where like people had my back. I wasn't paying them anything to do it. I wasn't making any money myself, so I was very grateful for that part of it. But it was just this very awesome culture where they literally gave me the keys and they said, we trust you. We know, what you're trying to do here. We want to stoke that part of you, and we think it's going to come back in dividends for us. And I thought the coolest thing was just like how my teammates rallied around me too, and like those are the same people that I was working accounts with. And that I would go with to be like, yo, can you help me with this, issue that the client is seeing? And we earlier in that night were like, or earlier in that week, we're like sharing a moment at a comedy show that I was running. And it was, and we were making a whole group of people laugh and throwing a cool event. And it was events. So you got to be like, yeah, this is how events are. This is what people go through. So it was very much Salesforce has that example or that saying, drinking your own champagne. We were just spraying that champagne all over each other. We were having a good time and really like learning how we could work with our clients who are also like going through similar event processes.
Yeah, I love it. It's such an inductive way of demonstrating the use of the software, which focuses on events. And because you'd have to go through the struggles of like doing the invitations, making sure people are RSVPing, doing the check-in. You would inductively find flaws and problems in the software as you leverage it yourself for the sake of your own event. So it's really, really smart. And it's so cool that it was allowed to unlock this kind of aspect. It reminds me also, there's a really good book. It's called Range, and it's how generalists triumph over specialists in a specialized age. And because your path is meandering, and I think there's an importance to that. There's a willingness to kind of recognize that, hey, there's going to be a lot of unexpected things that happen out of these situations, and I should dig into them. I should explore them, look for those opportunities for more responsibility. And I really love the highlight of the organization of sharing the credit, right? Of sharing the effort and sharing the credit, and that your point of wanting to prove them right next time, right? It's a very empowering thing to want more, a greater share of that now that you see people recognize it. And to me, it would make you give more effort, be more time, do more learning than anybody else could motivate out of you by mandating it or, any other kind of, if you think about the carrot, the stick analogy, right? There's a, anything with the stick. So it's very cool. So now that you've gone through, you explored this humor aspect and all of the, I love how you described it as an educational kind of tool as well, because we definitely learn a lot from humor. And so I'm curious, right? So as you think about, where you are now, because you started to get into a bit of how you started to take this humor and want to go even beyond the stand-up shows that you were starting to do. So pick it up there and let us know kind of how does this continue and how does humor continue to be this thread that you take with you?
Yeah, well, when the pandemic started, I had just had no idea kind of what I had just left the business to say this company that I was at for 6+ years, this to be like, this comedy thing is awesome. I love it. I don't know what I'm gonna do with it, but you guys have empowered me so much. I'm like, I love this. And I don't know what I want to do in comedy, but I want to be in comedy. And literally a month later, the pandemic started and I was like, what have I done? This is a bad idea. But my CEO called me, in the Throngs event, and he's like, I think you should be hosting corporate comedy shows for companies right now. And I was like, okay, like that's even how great this culture was that the CEO and I were close, but that he would be like, I got something that I still think about. Your skill set, and I think that you would be a really good fit for this, take it or leave it, whatever. And so that's what I did. And I started throwing one show, and it was, not just me. I was like, hey, I'm a pretty good comedian, but I know I've been amongst great comedians, and I'm so far from that. The delta is so big. Why don't I bring in comedians that are now officially not able to legally work because of the pandemic and because of the restrictions of working indoors. So I was able to bring in comedians that would otherwise be at in theaters. You know, one of which I'd said before is Jessica Kirsten. She was one of our two comedians, Ian Fidance and Jessica Kirsten. You know, huge names who were at the Comedy Cellar in New York City every single night and suddenly could not work anymore. And they took a chance with me, and I said, "Hey, let me just try to go get you some gigs." You know, my life or my skill set up to this point is in sales and is in using comedy skills that I've learned, and I know you, I speak your language, but I also my real skill set is like building you know, a demand generation or, you know, the sales function. And let me go get you. I'll host them and I'll host the events, but you guys are going to be really be doing them. And so that's what we did. It was just us three for a while, and then they recommended another person, and then we grew the roster off these recommendations until we had, you know, a ton of different comics for different styles. And, you know, it would be like, hey, what are you looking for? What's your age range? Or are people married, have kids? What do you want us to stay away from? And we started to be like, how do we craft the best comedy show that anybody will ever see at work based on demographics and data that we have before the event? And we match them with comedians that we already know all of their material because we've been working with them so closely, and we know where they're going to go, and more importantly, where they're not going to go. So let's go and pair them perfectly. And the shows were amazing. Like they were there, and we still follow that same model of injecting humor. And it was such a perfect time because people just needed comedy, they needed humor, they needed
Right.
that lift. That's when I started to actually look into the science of humor, like what is actually going on. And it was, I learned that, you know, when people laugh, their endorphins, they have a hit of endorphins, and their cortisol levels also go down. When they're laughing with other people, you know, there's a flush of serotonin. So people are feeling more connected with one another. And so I was seeing this in real time. And again, I was just like, there is something here with this laughter. How do we continue to do laughter? And you know, after the newness of these virtual comedy shows and the pandemic and virtual entertainment started to slow down, I developed a new product that we launched when everyone got back in person, and that was something called Laughing and Development, which were taking these comedy skills that I was learning in improv and in stand-up, and then creating custom workshops for companies so that their employees could be better active listeners, better communicators, better storytellers, thinking on their feet. And so, kind of continuing to be like, well, people are going to laugh when they do these workshops. Like, workshops are usually always so stale and very like sit down and watch. I was someone that I did management training workshops and they were effective, but also I needed a lot of coffee to stay through them. So, you know, I knew that laughter was itself like its own drug, you know, and this was what that there was actually a chemical thing happening. So I said, well, that's going to keep people interested. And when you laugh, your brain is able to remember it better. There's data that shows that when you laugh with like learning a new fact, you're more likely to remember the fact. And you're more likely to remember that point because you associate it with that moment of laughter. And so I was like, great, let's take laughing and then let's add that development component. And we'll basically, like, you know, again, going back to that wax on, wax off thing I referenced, that's kind of what it is. Like you're doing these things and you're going, I don't know why I'm doing this, but they're relevant. And then the next day, it has enhanced those people first power skills and you are suddenly not interrupting people during the workday. You are suddenly collaborating. I meant like when you're talking to people, you are listening better to your clients, you're problem solving, you're innovating a little bit better. And it was from doing these, you know, these muscles that seemingly atrophy because of, you know, all the specializations that we end up getting ourselves into. And even now, as the AI takes over a lot of our, you know, convergent thinking capabilities and our thinking in general, you know, it allows the rest of our muscles to sort of atrophy and just kind of let, you know, the humanness of ourselves be taken away. And so again, yeah, this allowed us to be close, allow people to get closer and really get something out of it at the same time.
Wow, it's fascinating. I love that idea of that things become more memorable. Recall becomes easier with laughter. I've always, in my work, it can be, as an architect and a consultant, people, there's a lot of money and risk on the line with these projects. And there's also, you're going into meetings where you're kind of parachuting into an existing political environment, right? And so it's important to recognize like how to observe different symbols and signs that help to discern what's going on here, right? Some people's perspectives here are not as respected. The highest paid person's opinion typically prevails here. And I tend to use laughter and throw it in various places in the meeting because it does depressurize the situation. And it tends to, off the back of a laugh, when everybody's laughing, the people who maybe wouldn't contribute typically now find it a much more safe environment to just interject something real quick. Like, well, based on what you're mentioning, I think that I'm not sure we've tried this before, but maybe it would work again. But they wouldn't have participated if the tension in the room remained so high, and the laughter helps to reduce that, and it makes everybody more relatable. I love that. I didn't know about the serotonin aspect, but there's certainly an aspect when you go to a show or a movie and you laugh together and then you both look at each other and you're laughing together, there is something about that shared experience that you keep with you. And when you're back in the office, you have that bond now that essentially, I may not know a ton more about that person. I don't know if they like me more or less, but because we had that shared experience, now it feels like we're closer and that I can act on that and maybe share something or invite them, or they're top of mind. I can share some important, valuable information with them just because we had that shared experience. And cultivating that on a regular basis
And you're
inside
not
the
even
organization is valuable.
you're not even remembering what you laughed at together. That's the best part. And that's like kind of that exchange of this like these hormones, It's like that's actually happening and you're not like you might remember it too, but like you really won't. You're gonna be like that. We just shared that
Yeah, it's not the
experience.
most critical part. The content wasn't the most critical part.
No. And that's like that's the difference between sharing. Obviously, I'm always a fan of sharing something funny with someone, like a video, but I want to share it with them. I'm like, hey, let's watch this together. Let's experience this moment together. And you said a few other things that I want to touch on, but like the first one being, opening with humor, and the second one being creating of a supportive environment. So one thing I noticed as I continued to do stand up, I didn't have like an opener that I was comfortable with, and I was like, hey. I started talking to some comedians with, decades and decades of experience and just asking them like, hey, what would the approach, what's your approach when you go for an opener? And you'll notice this now that I say this, comedians go for the opening laugh to invite the rest of the audience to be like, all right, now we're in. And you'll see them launching off of a laugh almost always. And they'll do that by recognizing something in the room, whether it's someone, a comedian, the host that came before them, a joke a comedian made right before while they were waiting to get up, the room that they're in. Whoa, this is, I always did mine in random basements in New York. So they'll be like, great, I'm performing at a basement in New York City, kind of like a deprecating thing.
Yes, exactly. Boy, I'll be sure to call my mom.
Exactly. Like, oh, I worked so hard to be performing in a basement, and everyone is like laugh so hard at this seemingly small thing, but you're telling the audience and going, I've got eyes, I've got ears, and so do you. We're in this together. I know what you're thinking, and now you know what I'm thinking. And they laugh in that recognition. And usually almost all of them, it's like you're on a boogie board. You're like, I got the wave, let's ride, And you're going through that, and that's such an important thing to like what you said. You're now creating an environment of support. And it's the same in stand-up and in improv. In improv, it's like, hey, everyone on the stage with me, we're supporting each other. And that's the support that we're creating in this moment. We're kind of performing with each other, for each other. When it comes to stand-up, it's no different. Like when you're opening that up, you're telling the audience like, hey, this is a place to laugh. You know, this is a place to share a, not don't interrupt me, but like this is a place to like you can laugh at stuff here and you can be open to sharing. And just like you said, that's going to, if you're able to get one person to emote with a laughter, you're so much more likely to get them to share something they either wouldn't say anything in the first place or even just be more vulnerable because they're like, I get this person, I'm in. And it's so important how those first minutes are not spent asking what the weather is like. And those minutes are spent with diving deeper in to be like, man, let me ask questions and maybe get something or recognizing something funny in the Zoom or in their background. And now we're off to the races, and now we can really have a productive call.
Yeah, that's good. One of the aspects, right, the first session in my the course on the People First Method side is how to leverage small talk as strategy, and that's certainly part of the equation is, you're just meeting some of these people, and so, using some, of course, non-offensive but self-deprecating or observational humor definitely does draw people in, and it's amazing how it popcorns. That's what I think about, right? Because when someone You make someone laugh about something, they love that feeling so much, they'll highlight, like you've done, like, oh, whether they saw something else that was like this, or just the other day, or just this morning, right? And all of a sudden now they're letting people know more about themselves, and they're kind of drawing. And then that just often can be this catalyst that it just continues through the room, almost to the point where we have to be like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. We're gonna have to probably continue this a little later. But what a great problem to have that we were just overflowing with this engagement as a team. And how often does that happen if someone is not intentional about making it happen, especially in the beginning? And I think that's what I love about it, is going back to the risk-taking and the willingness to do something vulnerable for the sake of drawing these people together. And that's what it takes. It takes someone who's willing to take some initiative and take a little risk. Right, and see where it goes. So very
Absolutely.
cool. So as it is today, do you kind of help me understand that you have this example where you had almost like the speakers bureau for comedians, right? And comedians who were doing, kind of educational and like workshop oriented elements. Is that kind of what they were doing? Were they
So it was
Were they just
two sides
intros
of
to the material, or how is it kind of correlating with the goal of the workshop at the
Yes, yeah, so
beginning?
it's two sides of our business, like the still stuff that we started with, which is the entertainment side of things. And it is more of a speakers bureau for entertainment and comedy and more things where people are just l looking to have some corporate fun. And then the other side of our business, which is the laughing and development side, this is where we will take the way that we like ensure that it's not just like any improv class, and that is very specific to what we do, is that we do a pre-event survey with the organizer, who's usually the manager, whoever it might be, and be like, what's the vibe of the team? But also, like, what do you want to learn? Like, do you want this to be like professional development heavy? Or do you want everyone just to get like silly and comfortable with each other? Do you want both? Like, what is the components or what are your company values that you're looking to like reiterate? And we'll subliminally do that and be like, hey, this is why it's important to put clients first, or whatever it might be, or co-create. You know, at the company I worked with that we've been talking about, like we had such amazing core values, and it was so important to continue to reiterate that constantly. And I always felt like, okay, everything that I'm doing, that the company is doing, should reflect those core values. So we asked them to tell us their core values because it allows us to speak in their words and something that they don't just talk about every once a year or when things get hard and this is what we're doing. It's like, no, how are you actually owning your core values? And, you know, not to rag on other things people could do, but like, what's relevant about a murder mystery in your core values? What is relevant about a boat cruise in your core values? I'm not saying don't have fun. We have an entertainment side of our business that's for people wanting to have fun. But like, what are you doing that's mixing fun with professional development? Because of what I said earlier, like, how are you getting people to own this stuff and recognize it? Laughter's a great way to do that. But like, how can you really effectively and efficiently engage your team because it's not that common that you get to be together in one setting, looking people in the eye, arm in arm, and kind of really taking that moment and, hey, let's connect with one another on stuff that's not about our work, our jobs, our even our per, even like our what we do after work. It's like, no, what are our, not to be so heavy, but like our souls, like how can we kind of connect our like our things that don't make up necessarily who we are on LinkedIn or who we are on Instagram or whatever? How do we connect with like who we are as people?
No, I love that. And I think I think actually people are, every day becoming more desperate for that, so as more and more of our lives are mediated by technology, whether that's I'm using Slack for most of my communications with my teammates now. I'm in a hybrid or remote work environment. My one-on-ones might be asynchronous with my boss, right? Where I write something or maybe record something. As more of that is mediated, people, they're losing venues where they feel like they're really known, and they feel like that the important things that really make us human, those people first priorities, are diminished because it's mediated by, technologies that have no awareness, and certainly no opinion about these aspects. And so I think this, fostering these kind of connections and this platform is really key to helping draw people together, because ultimately we need that human connection. It's not something that's optional. People lose their understanding of like what is the meaning of life when we don't connect with people. And the people we work with, we often are in touch with more than our own families, just by nature of what the workday looks like.
And
And so
there was a
it's really critical.
guy I worked with early on who loved what we were doing and did a testimonial after, and I remember talking to him, and he was saying, "We're f like we just have these constant transactions happening at work, whether it's a Slack or a meeting or an email. It's like these tons of these different transactions that are, you step away from it, and you're like, who am I talking to? Like, and like, who is this person? And it's like, how if you are doing all of these transactions, what kind of deposits are you making in the social aspect of it? And again, I don't mean social in the sense of, a rowdy good time. I mean social in the sense of connection and that human connection and building authenticity. And like, sure, you have to have a huge ledger of transactions that are happening to push your business forward. And that's what productivity is. But what is going to get you to build a culture that's going to not look allow your employees to be like, okay, salaries are the same, my perks are the same. Actually, maybe this person's going to offer a little bit more, or maybe like you start to like if you make people look at your company and your job and you can compare it to others, and it's not so clear that like, oh, but this one that I've been in really invests in our ability to connect, and I'm closer with people. I met my wife at Splash where we worked. And so like that, I have some of my best friends that were at my at our wedding and that I'm still very close with. And it was because so many we knew when to work hard, we knew when to put those transactions in, but we spent so much time and they invested so much energy, as much as money, into making sure that we felt like we were going to war with each other and we had each other's backs.
Yeah, I love that. Emotional commitment is so important. Well, this is good, and this has certainly been a wonderful challenge to fit it into one person's, average commute, with is about an hour. And so it's been a pleasure. So how can people, if they wanted to find out more information, how could they track you down?
Yeah, we got our website is laugh.events, and our newsletter, which I kind of talk about all this stuff. That's probably the best way to go and subscribe. It's laughrx.laugh.events, and then you can always connect with me on LinkedIn. Always sharing good nuggets there. Just Kevin Hupschman on LinkedIn. So those are those top threes.
Great. I'll put them in the show notes, and really appreciate the time today, and hope we get a lot more, kind of laughs and eventually love, right? Which you found at work, which is great. But certainly, right, that's just the beginning and can lead to a lot of great things. So appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of Salesforce Trails and Trials. If you found this episode valuable, we would love your help reaching others. Please subscribe, leave us a 5-star review, and share this with another who would benefit.